I have something to play for you now from the RN archive. See if you can guess the voice. It was recorded about 20 years ago, and he's talking about two of his great loves.
100 up once more to Bradman, McKay being 67, and two down for 218. Hear the cheering breaking out in the great outer stand, which is comfortably filled today, and the game is held up whilst we await next ball from Hammond. Hammond does not wait for the pause to die down, and oh, another sweet shot, late cut. Here comes
one of the most striking similarities between these two is the strong feelings which each stimulates, not only for, but also against. Enthusiasts can become boringly preachy, sometimes even mystical. I think I've always been this way about cricket. Wagner, on the other hand, is a more recently acquired taste. I can still recall, prior to this latter addiction, being approached by someone at a party and asked whether I was a Wagner man. It was rather like receiving a Masonic handshake. But it wasn't long before I, too, was an initiate.
Well, that's a very short extract of Wagner and Cricket, composed by my last very welcome guest today, Andy Ford. And I'll ask Andy to explain this composition in a moment. But the reason we've invited my colleague to sit opposite to me in the studio is because he has taken pen to paper, a very old-fashioned way to describe it, I suppose, to write a sort of a memoir, as he describes it, The Memory of Music. It's a reflection over time of the place of music in our culture. But more than that, I think, it's an effort to unravel its magic and reduce it to words. Now, I'm going to, that word, that verb reduce is something I'll come back to. Andy's been presenting the music show for 22 years now, but it's only his very part-time job as he's a composer of operas, symphonies, nursery rhymes, and in his spare time, he writes about music very well indeed, in my view, in books and in columns, which always pique my interest. Andy, thank you very much for sparing the time to talk to us.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. That, I should just say, though, that Wagner and cricket thing was 30 years ago, not 20 years.
30 years ago. So tell us a bit more about it, please.
Well, it occurred to me that the Ring cycle takes four nights to play, Wagner's Ring of the Nibelung, and the test match takes 5 days, and it would be technically possible to enjoy both simultaneously over the course of 5 days and four nights. And then I thought, well, they have a lot in common. You know, they're both quite slow in their way. They take a long time
to build.
You know, 6 hours of cricket in a day in a test match, and I suppose about 4 hours of music in Wagner, each of the four operas, about 16 hours in total. And they have their detractors who say that it's too slow. And, you know, and there are very slow moments. And then there's this kind of, they flare up and something very dramatic happens. I thought that they had a lot in common.
Well, I hadn't thought of that. You've piqued me to think, as you always do. And I did say that I'd focus on that verb reduce because you may not like that notion, but you are really trying, I think, in this to analyse the chemistry of music, the magic of music. And you've got this marvellous line, which is so obvious, but I've never heard anybody put it like this before. Music doesn't exist on its own. It requires a listener.
Yes.
Now, that's a little epiphany for me. You talk about epiphanies later, but that's a little epiphany for me.
Well, I mean, I'd go a bit further than that, actually, and suggest that the listener, in a way, makes the music. Because if even something which we would all probably agree was music, like Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, is playing and we're trying to concentrate on something else, because, of course, we can hear music accidentally and mostly do these days, it becomes irritating noise. It stops being music. On the other hand, if you pay close attention, as I was just this morning walking along to the bird song and thinking how it sort of floated on top of the traffic noise, which was in the distance, and there were these two different layers. I mean, there's nothing to... I mean, you could say that that was music because I was listening very intently to it, and I was sort of making sense of it in my mind as I was doing so. So I think that the listener is crucial when it comes to music.
Because even what you made me realise, I mean, a book exists on its own, whether or not it's read. So does a piece of art. So does a beautiful building or whatever. But music on the... Even music played that no one's listening to, I don't know what it is.
Well, I mean, certainly if we go back to the Moonlight Sonata, if it just sits there in a book, the score is there, but the score isn't the music.
No.
But Beethoven didn't intend his Moonlight Sonata to be played in a concert hall for hundreds, let alone thousands of people. He intended it to be played by people who bought it and took it home in the way that people used to buy records and take them home. This was the earlier equivalent. Everybody had a piano and you would prop up the music and you'd learn the piece and you'd play it. And so you, the performer, was the listener. So there was no distinction there. You were playing it for yourself. Mm. And that changed in time.
So it's a very communal... I mean, you do have this very interesting observation about what has been very popular in the music show's life is the technicality of music. Now, I wasn't expecting that.
So no, it's sort of counterintuitive, isn't it? Because you would assume that the more technical you get, the more you lose listeners who don't understand the technical terms. But we've discovered over the years, and we've been doing it a long time now, as you said, that actually that's the bit they really, really like. And we get a mailbag, you know, a much bigger mailbag than we would otherwise. And when, particularly when somebody is sitting at an instrument, or if this we find some other way of illustrating the technicalities, then people love to be taken inside a piece of music and find out how it works. And I suppose if you like something, you do want to know something about it. And also, I think music, the mechanics of music are quite mysterious for most people now, mm. in a way that they didn't used to be when people bought their Beethoven sonatas and took them home and played them to themselves. I mean, people don't do that anymore, and they think that people who do it are incredibly clever. And in fact, they're not that clever. It is still very much a part of life, but it's a different kind of part of life because we now are mostly consumers of music rather than practitioners. Yes.
You had your own epiphany, and I am going to read this because this particularly illustrates the point you're just trying to make. You had your own epiphany going to hear Beethoven's Ninth, the Choral Symphony, and you realised, and I'll let you describe it. The moment that got me comes midway through the finale, following the variation on the famous Ode to Joy theme, that Beethoven turns into a Turkish march, the tenor soloist joining in with a tune that always seems to have escaped from a beer keller. This is followed by a serious fugal workout for orchestra alone, but then comes a mysterious ruminative passage in which the French horns have repeating F sharps in a rhythm reminiscent of a heartbeat. Over this, oboes and bassoons play a tentative ascending figure in D major, which leads nowhere. They try it in D minor, still nowhere. Finally, they settle for the dominant key of A, and without warning, we are whisked abruptly back to the chorus, loudly and triumphantly punching out Schiller's Ode in D. Now, honestly, even as I read that, I can feel the hairs on my arms standing up as I'm hearing it in my mind. Tell us about that moment for you, please.
Well, I wasn't even at a concert. I was listening to a recording in my parents' lounge room, and I would have been about 15 or 16, maybe, and I burst into tears, and it was extraordinary moment. And I thought at the time it might have been something religious going on, and pursued that line of thought for quite a while, actually. But I don't think it was. I think what was happening...
Because you say it actually possessed you physically.
Well, music does that, doesn't it? I mean, that's one of the things about music that makes it different to the other arts. It not only envelops us literally, the sound of the music is around, but it's also inside us. Now, it's not much of a stretch to start talking about God at that point, being within and without, to quote George Harrison. And so I can see why the two things do get confused in a lot of people's minds. And I can also see why some religions don't like music because of the potential confusion. That's right. You know, I mean, what is it that you're being carried away by when you're singing a hymn? Is it the music? Is it, or is it some religious fervour?
Well, I suppose one could argue it's part of that the brain that looks for something beyond, it, almost the metaphysical, isn't it?
Yes.
That looks beyond the everyday. In fact, you've got Debussy saying music is pure emotion. And that Australian composer, Larry Sitsky, music is like a telescope into the unknown.
Yes, that's a nice one too. But I particularly like the Debussy, that music is pure emotion, because I think the thing about music, and I think this is the reason it's hard to talk about, and the reason why when we try and talk about it, even when we're quite successful, we are, to use your word, reducing it to words, is that music bypasses reason. It goes into our ears and it sort of goes straight to wherever our emotions are, and we feel it, and then we maybe try to make sense of it. And maybe this is why the technical stuff on the music show always appeals to people, because they're hoping that that emotional response to music, which most people have, is something which can be explained. And there are bad emotional responses as well as good emotional responses.
Indeed, there are. Especially to Wagner.
Especially, yes, but that usually comes because you know something about Wagner. I think when people say they don't like Wagner, it's more often than not the man.
Making music, you say, is almost the antithesis of what you've just described. It's like cottage gardening.
Oh, well, that's just my job. People talk about the music industry. I think that's an awful cliche, and it makes no sense at all. I don't feel as though I'm part of an industry.
What if you were, though? Would it be a shocking thing?
Well, I don't know how I could be. Because composers mostly work at home on their own, and it's quite quiet, and you make this music, and it is like being a cottage gardener. It's like going out and watering your plants and making things grow, and then you take them to market. But I don't think somebody who grows lettuce thinks they're part of a lettuce industry.
Maybe the agriculture industry, but all right, I won't dwell on that. But it is about the business. What I suppose I was getting at is you're assembling bits and bobs together, aren't you? It's certainly an unromantic task.
Oh, yes, it's very, very much work. And some days it's very hard work, and some days it goes wonderfully and it's exciting, and you look at what you've written at the end of the day and you think, how did all that get there? But then there are days when it's been a struggle, and the next morning you sit down and look at what you did the day before and you tear it all up. You know, there are days when you can do a day's work where at the end of it you've got less than when you started. So sometimes it's very hard and sometimes it's not. But I've never found that there was any correlation between how hard it was to write a piece and how good the piece is.
Where do you think this all started? Because I think a lot of people will be listening thinking, how do I hand this on if I've got this love to my children, say?
You just play them things and encourage them to listen. I mean, listening is the key, isn't it, to everything in music, having open ears, not coming to something with preconceptions, because if you approach any kind of art with preconceptions, then you're not going to get very much out of it.
You do talk about parents singing.
Oh, yes, I think that's important. I mean, that's the ultimate live performance, isn't it? It's a command performance that takes place on the end of your bed. And in a way, it doesn't matter what the music is, in a way, because what it is, it's the bond between the child and the parent's voice, and the fact that it's being done just for them, and the fact that it was done the same way the night before.
I take it that you include grandparents in that. I certainly do plenty of that. And then you join choirs, which is exactly what happened in my life too.
Yes, that's a very good idea.
Andrew Ford, congratulations. I think you haven't reduced it. I think you've augmented it, but I really do. I've found it very interesting to read, so thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Geraldine.
And Andy presents The Music Show, of course, here on RN, author of many books, including the latest, The Memory of Music. It's published by Black Ink Books.